I am Brother Cornell West, and this is
If I Can Save America.
Peace and love, everybody. It's your man, Manny Faces. Just wanted to let you know that Hip Hop Can Save America is now available as a live stream show every Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on YouTube. You can find it at hiphopcansaveamerica.com/watch. Excerpts from that show will be played here on the audio feed, so you'll still get the good interviews that you've been used to. But check out the live stream and check out my free Substack newsletter at mannyfaces.substack.com. That's filled with all kinds of stories of hip-hop innovation, inspiration, and generally hip-hop news that isn't about dumb shit. For everything Hip Hop Can Save America, hiphopcansaveamerica.com. For everything Manny Faces, mannyfaces.com. And if you find value in this work, you can support it. We'd love to have you aboard as a supporter at patreon.com/mannyfaces. Now let's go.
The thing about hip hop today is it's smart. It's insightful. The way that they can communicate a complex message in a very short space is remarkable. And a lot of these kids, they're not going to be reading the New York Times. That's not how they're getting their information. My hip hop will rock and shock the nation. Hip hop culture is more than music. Peace to you and speak the truth. Showing what peace can do when there reads for you. My hip hop will rock and shock the nation. Rap is something you do, hip hop is something you live.
So hip hop didn't invent anything, but hip hop reinvented everything.
From weeks after Big was killed, the LAPD has never been interested in solving this case because it involved LAPD officers. And right. That's a fact.
Peace and love, y'all. It's your man, Manny Faces. Welcome back to the world's smartest, most important, and most enlightening hip-hop podcast, the award-winning Hip Hop Can Save America. Now, this is an interesting one. For years, Don Sikorsky has studied the murder of Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. the Notorious B.I.G., a.k.a. Christopher Wallace. Now, so have a lot of people. Stories about what happened, why it happened, who's to blame, and why there hasn't been justice are all over the place. When you really get into it, there's enough twists and turns to these questions, it sounds like a movie. And it was. 2018's City of Lies starred Johnny Depp and Forrest Whitaker. You may not have seen it. You may not have known about it, but it told the story up until that point, a story which included many things that had been rumored over the years. Orders on high from Suge Knight, a hitman, and in between, crooked LAPD cops that would stop at nothing to cover up their involvement. City of Lies, which was produced by Sikorsky, was just the start. The web of deceit, corruption, and cover-up that surrounds this case reaches high into state and federal government and involves more characters and plot twists than anyone could keep track of. Well, almost anyone. In his podcast, The Dossier, now in its second season, Sikorsky continues to hunt for the truth. And with extensive, exclusive documents in his possession, he seems to be able to do it in a way that others can't. Now, if you know me, you know I'm not one to get into the salacious, gossipy, culture vultury ways that certain people capitalize on the ways that hip-hop and crime sometimes connect. But as a journalist, I respected Sikorsky's process and products, so I wanted to know a little bit more about both. But I'll admit, I also wanted to get a better picture as to why Biggie's murder hasn't been solved. And man, did I. So, here it is. My conversation with TV and film producer and creator and host of The Dossier podcast, Don Sikorsky. Don Sikorsky, thank you for joining me today, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Manny. How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as I guess can be expected these days. So I'll take that. Any day that's good is great. I want to thank you for joining me. I've been digging into The Dossier, the podcast. I've given people a little bit of a rundown of who you are and why we're speaking tonight. But I'd like to just give you the space to, you know, introduce yourself as you like to be presented to the world. Sometimes we just read people's bios and that's not how they're feeling that day. So please, if you would, tell people who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I like to call myself an investigative journalist and my day job is a television producer. I graduated from NYU. What I've always liked to dig into is stories that surround criminal justice, stories that surround the courts, jails, police corruption, and specifically for some of my career, the intersection of all of that stuff as it relates to hip hop music, right? Because I think the story of hip hop also delves into criminal justice.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, for sure a lot of crossover along those lines. So I want to start at the end and then, well, not at the end, but at the where we are, and then we'll go backwards in time a little bit. In reference to your work covering, in particular, the Biggie Smalls murder, in reference to the movie, the Dossier podcast, and everything that's led up to the point where we are right now today on this date in 2023, is the criminal case into the murder of Biggie Smalls still open?
So if you were to ask the Los Angeles Police Department, they would tell you, yes, that would be a lie. And that would be sort of their public perception that they want people to believe. But from weeks after Big was killed, the LAPD has never been interested in solving this case because it involved LAPD officers. And that's a fact. So they will tell you it's open. But again, that is just a laundry list of things that they've lied about.
Right. And again, I just want to, before I go even further, the meticulous details, the line of investigation that you've gone through throughout many years now, maybe over a decade, I'm not quite sure, that details the things that you're talking about is incredible when you look at the effort that it must have taken to, you know, come across all the stuff that you've come across. And we'll go into that. Is the civil case against the LAPD regarding the death of Christopher Wallace Biggie Smalls by the Wallace family, is that still open?
Well, there's two different versions that I've been told by the lawyers for the Wallace family. And one of them I still don't understand, and it is the following. There was a period of time that Ms. Wallace had to refile the civil case against the LAPD for the wrongful death lawsuit. And if she did not file it, Biggie's kids could then file it. That hasn't happened. In season two of my podcast, towards the end, I'm trying to get those answers now because that's a gray area that exists. I do know that there are people within the FBI and I think within the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles that are kind of looking at this possibly as a criminal investigation again. I don't have all of the details about that. But as far as the civil case being refiled, that has not happened as of yet.
Understood. So where did this start for you in terms of, and I don't want to do the DJ Vlad thing. I'm not going to ask all the questions that you spend all the time in the podcast answering. Yeah, I want people to listen to the podcast. I want, you know, the season, the first scene, second scene, go see the movie, you know, City of Lies that you've produced as well. Where did this all start? And then we'll kind of a little bit quickly. It's a long story. We don't have all that day. You've been doing this for a million years. But I would like to know sort of the chronology of how this this started and evolved for you as a journalist, as a filmmaker. Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, for me, there was two things with this story that I wanted to do. The first thing is I never felt that the story of Christopher Wallace was ever a story about police corruption, social justice, or the criminal justice system. And I said, how do you tell that story, right? And that's a bigger story. And secondarily to that, when I went into this, I have to be honest, I looked at all of the stuff that had been done on Big and Pac, and I said, there's really nothing else to do. Everyone is really talked, in a sense, or told the same stories over and over again. And I found FBI agent Phil Carson. And I said, here is an FBI agent who has never spoken, who his only goal was to get to the truth of what happened and why it was covered up. And not only did he do that, he was shut down by very powerful people within the city of Los Angeles, right? So you had an amazing character who could take you inside of this machine of Los Angeles over a period of time and show police corruptions, show corruption of the United States attorney. And that's a powerful story, right? Because I come from, you know, went to college in the 90s in New York City, and there's these seminal police corruption cases that you see, the Central Park Five, Sean Bell, Eric Gardner, right? And I said to myself, the story of Christopher Wallace, albeit it is a music hip hop success story, you can't tell one without the sort of criminal justice side of his story. And secondarily to that, you have one of the largest ever police cover-ups that's ever been orchestrated in this country surrounding his death, right? That's an important story to tell that I continue to try to tell it, because it's my contention is there are people within the Los Angeles Police Department, within the United States Attorney's Office, that know the truth. And the hope is that one day more people will tell it and really make people understand how this cover-up operated.
Yeah. So it is, again, and again, this is the big, you know, a big overarching question. The Los Angeles Police Department, in an effort to avoid, from what I understand from certainly listening to more recent episodes, in a specific effort to avoid having to pay hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in a civil lawsuit, as well as embarrassment, all the other kind of things that could happen, mistrust now between, you know, law enforcement and the public, have since day one been covering this up, their involvement, the involvement of officers who helped facilitate this event.
Yes, sir. I was in a meeting one time at a television studio, and as television executives tend to do, after he heard this full story, he kind of looked at me and he was like, well, this is really a billion-dollar cover-up. And I said, I mean, his estate with what it's worth now, I think at the time that Miss Wallace was suing the city of Los Angeles and the LAPD, Keith Klinkscales got up on the stand at the civil trial and walked through Biggie's earnings or future earnings of what his estate and his music and his value as a global superstar, right? And could have been or, at that time, you know?
Yeah.
And listen, there was people who came to Phil Carson and said, if this civil lawsuit is to be proven true, you could bankrupt a city institution. A $500 million settlement is a massive amount of money for a city, you know, if you really think about it. And whether they rectify that at some point, I don't know. You know, maybe there's a version of the Wallace family getting some form of closure on this, right? Because that's the other thing for the Wallace family, you know?
Yeah, I've seen interviews with folks who are associated with or whatever, and you know, they talk about how painful it must be to, over all these years, A, still have to go in, like, you still got to deal with it. Every time you go into a new filing or a new thing or a new rumor or a new story, you relive the whole thing. But at the same time, you've never quite gotten the justice, I think, that everyone would want for someone in there. And their family. Again, just taking it back a little bit, you worked on this case as a journalist. How did the movie come about? How did your involvement, like, taking this really from covering it to blowing it out in media?
Yeah, I have a very good friend of mine, Brad Furman, who is a Hollywood film director. He directed Lincoln Lawyer. I produced another film with him called The Infiltrator with Bryan Cranston and John Leguizamo. In Hollywood for many years, there was a book that was floating around called Labyrinth that was written by Randall Sullivan. And that book had been optioned by Sylvester Stallone. It had been optioned by Leonardo DiCaprio. And it was this property within Hollywood that people had tried to make, but had just never made it. And me and Brad were able to get the rights to the book. And we set out to make the movie. Now, the big piece of that puzzle in Hollywood is always a big name. At that time, Brad was able to convince Johnny Depp to play Russell Poole, and Forrest Whitaker sort of played this journalist character that was created to sort of infuse the investigative parts of this that Randall's book brought forth. And we spent about 4 years making that movie, and it just so happened the timing of it all sort of happened at the same time. The movie was coming together. I sort of met Phil and was putting the pieces of the puzzle together about Phil, right? And so in this weird synergistic way, timing is everything in life, this all kind of came together in that moment. The dossier was created and City of Lies was created. And I think they're, you know, they're kind of, if you watch City of Lies, at the end of City of Lies is where Dossier picks up, right?
I was going to say, and, sort of, what's the revelation in the movie, right? Because there had to be a big, you know, kicker in the movie. And then what then did you discover that turned into then the work you've been doing since?
In the movie, the story of Russell Poole is he is the first LAPD detective to be given the Biggie case. And he starts to investigate it, and he's on the right path. And he is finding involvement of LAPD officers with connections to death row. And Russell Poole's career is ruined at the LAPD. Mm-hmm. Now, cut to when Russ Poole is pushed out of the LAPD and retires, Phil Carson takes what Randall Poole did. He actually brings on Randall Poole as a confidential informant within his federal investigation. And Phil Carson, in a similar way, is sort of told, you can't look this way. You can't look into this. This is too big. Like, if you continue this investigation, there's going to be massive problems within the city of Los Angeles. So they have like singular and similar paths. The only difference is Phil Carson was not pushed out of the FBI because he, you know, went and found out the truth of the Biggie murder investigation. The opposite of that, he retired a decorated FBI agent, and the FBI supported his investigation into the murder of Biggie. But in Los Angeles, the United States Attorney, officials within the city, officials within the LAPD are more powerful than the FBI, if you can believe that. That is true.
Interesting.
In that particular instance, for the most part, people think the FBI, they think all powerful, all knowing. Right. In this particular instance in Los Angeles, the powers that be had enough power to kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, push the FBI away from doing this case for a number of reasons. One, money. Two, that it would have ruined the relationship between the LAPD and the FBI in Los Angeles, who worked together. Right. A lot. So that's really the path of this story.
Yeah. Question about this cover up, this idea that it exists. There's two parts of this. There's one is the fact that a murder happened, and everyone pretty much agrees that a murder happened. This was a murder, and the cover up part of it. So again, here's another big overarching question that we don't have to get into all the details. It's what I want people to follow the show and listen to. Did these investigators know definitively who killed Biggie?
Yes, they knew definitively who killed Biggie weeks after Biggie was killed. There are internal LAPD documents. There was an internal LAPD investigation that happened. And inside these internal LAPD documents, which I discovered, it states in plain sight that Rafael Perez and David Mack and possibly Kevin Gaines were involved in the murder of Biggie. You know,
these were officers.
These were LAPD officers. And
right.
And the LAPD's own investigation into this, meaning internal affairs, right? Because if you really truly understand the story, David Mack, Rafael Perez, they had massive internal affairs files and documents, right? And these files really tell the story of who they were as cops and as corrupt cops. And so when this happened, there was enough information that existed for the LAPD themselves to go, oh shit, these guys were involved. And that is when the sort of handling of this at the highest levels of the LAPD started, you know? And that kind of makes sense because, I mean, you can just do the calculus on that goes on inside of that building, right? We have dirty cops. We've coming off the Rodney King. We're coming off, you know, the Rampart police scandal, which was a massive scandal in Los Angeles. And then, oh my God, now we have one of hip hop's rising stars murdered as part of a conspiracy with our dirty officers. It's almost unbelievable in a way.
It sounds like a movie. it should have been a movie, and then it's real life, and then it was a movie. Now it's even more of a movie, I think, because now we've talked about, obviously, the things you've discovered since then. And let me just, while I got you, the journalist in me and the journalist in you, the investigative part, the forensics of digging through, you're a guy, and there's a few guys that say things about what happened in this case, right? And there's a few theories and theorists and folks and, But what I think separates, maybe, as far as I could tell from looking at, folks that have been covering this for years, going past, like you said, the stuff that everyone says, and then going past the salaciousness of it all, is the paperwork, is the paper trail. Can you just give an idea for those who aren't journalists, how deep that pile of papers must be, or roomfuls, and the process in securing that stuff, and how important that is to covering any story of human life?
That is a big part of what I did in the podcast. Is, to your point, I saw a lot of people go out publicly and talk about these things and not tell the truth, right? And so what I wanted to do in this investigation is I wanted to not only tell a story, but I wanted to back it up and substantiate it with internal documents of the entities that were involved. Now, I will tell you, I have three different, let's say, groupings of files that I was able to acquire, okay? The first batch of files I have are what are considered the original LAPD homicide investigation by Russell Poole. Those are, like, let's call them step one, right? The second set of files that I think are the most valuable is when Miss Wallace and the Wallace family filed their civil lawsuit against the city of Los Angeles. Like any criminal or civil case, there's something called discovery. And what that means is the LAPD and the city of Los Angeles had to hand over to the Wallace family a massive treasure trove of internal LAPD documents, okay?
Right.
Now, those documents are under federal seal, which means they were under federal seal by a federal judge saying these documents are not to be made public. Mrs. Wallace's private investigator, Sergio Robledo, gave me those files, okay? And in looking at that, that is where you have this massive amount of internal LAPD information and case files, and it names the names of the people of the cover-up in black and white. There's no denying of it. I'm not sitting here guessing on this. It's in the paperwork. And then lastly, and this part I was given by a source who I cannot reveal, I have all of the FBI files as it relates to Biggie's homicide and cover-up that was acquired by the FBI and were unredacted. So then those are the three batches of documents that I have that I based my storytelling on and my journalism on. This isn't rumor. This isn't the word of whoever I brought on to talk about this stuff, because as you know, people now are so readily available to sort of twist and turn and tell lies for personal gain, for money, whatever it was. And I said, I'm going to base this on fact and documents and the truth, right? And I felt if I did that, no one can really say anything to me. They could say a lot of things to a lot of other people, but they can't, because you know what? I can show it to them and go, here you go. You don't believe me. Yeah. Why don't you read it? Now, what I will be doing very shortly is releasing all these documents to the public so everyone else can read them and see the truth. You know? And hopefully use them to further my work, because I have nothing to hide. You know, I just want to tell the story of this as a police cover-up and police corruption, and let people really understand the truth, right? And I think that's a very simple thing when you're doing that.
Yeah, indeed. Interesting. I find it that listening to the show, this is a question now as a fellow podcast producer, and I do some other shows as well. Are you doing the Dossier Series 2 sort of as you go? Or is it already, have you already finished it and you know everything, or you're waiting?
Funny story, in season one, when I started it, I had 10 episodes. And what happened is right. I felt the story wasn't over. So I was writing and editing episodes in like a week where I would write the script on a Monday. I would do an interview and then I would release it on a Friday. Season two, I have about 10 episodes done. But with this story, it never shocks me of the people who, as I've been telling this, have reached out, said, I've listened to this. You're actually telling the real story. And guess what? For the first time, I want to come and speak to you about what I know. And and so what am I going to do? Say no? It's like, I'm like, yes, of course, get that information. And I can sort of create and write these episodes if I have the information in a pretty efficient manner, because I don't have to answer to anyone but the truth and myself and what I think is great and good. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of like, I start out with like a base level and then I'm like, oh man, I need like 10 more.
Right. I got you. I can imagine discovering stuff along the way and saying, well, you know, here's got to add one to the pile, one more episode or one more bonus. I see you do bonus episodes as well to fill in some of those gaps. What would be somebody's, you know, if someone's saying, listen, I've watched the Who Killed Tupac and Biggie's and I've read the books and I've seen the movies and I hear about it all the time. And, you know, I've heard about this guy and I've heard about that guy and I've watched Vlad and I've watched Dialogue and all these places. We'll give you a chance to brag a little bit maybe and say, you know, what is something that you've come across or you've discovered or that you've presented that's like, you could tell I'm the one doing this, or this story is the one that's most accurate according to, like you say, the actual facts. What would be one thing to tell people? Now, pay attention to what I'm saying.
Well, I think what you have to pay attention to is the story of Phil Carson, because to your point, when I first met Phil as an FBI agent and he told me a story, I kind of was looking for the angle. Does that make sense? Right. I kind of was looking for why does he want to, does he have an axe to grind? Was he this disgruntled guy?
Right.
What I realize now 5-6 years later is Mr. Carson or Phil Carson does not say anything he can't substantiate. And I found in dealing with him, his character and his morals are of the utmost. And it's hard to find that a lot of times in law enforcement, because what you have is guys who are kind of, you know, pushed out, their reputations are ruined. This is the opposite of that, right? So you listen to Phil Carson because he had the tools to get to the truth. He could wiretap phones. He could look at bank records. He could interview. He interviewed in upwards of, you know, 20 different confidential informants and confidential sources, right? For many years, he was a part of a team inside the FBI that was undercover inside of Death Row Records and had that information, right? So listen to that. And I think the other thing is when what Brad did when he directed City of Lies is he made sure that he took all of the, for lack of a better word, investigative work product that had been done by Randall Sullivan or myself or Sergio Robledo, and he put that into that film. So that film is actually, if you really watch it, is a, sometimes in Hollywood, they kind of twist things and they turn things around. If you
dramatization.
Watch that, it is based on the absolute fact of these investigations. And he wanted to do that for a reason, because, you know, there's a higher thing that's going on here, and that is to point out the corruption of the LAPD. So I don't mean to be selfish in saying, look at City of Lies and look at my podcast, but I also would say, look at the work of Randall Sullivan, who did two books and was very close, and he's a real journalist, you know? He's a real journalist, and he did his work.
Yeah, the second book, Dead Wrong, I think Randall Sullivan's.
I apologize to Randall. I always forget the second title of that, but that's a very incredible book that people should read also, because he does into the nitty gritty of it.
There's alignment with what you've come across and what he's come across. There are, however, and I don't want, like I said, get into too much of it. I won't keep you too long. There are folks out there that say that you know, certain people, certain investigators weren't telling the truth or were misled by witnesses or had shaky witnesses. So I want to know if like some of the other theories that have been out there, some of the other directions that people have been put in, are there efforts to this day to seed information? We live in the world, the age of disinformation, right? So is that continuing to happen from those involved? Or is it just like you say earlier, sort of everyone kind of just putting their own spin on it?
No, I do believe for many reasons, there are still people who have done two things. They've realized that them holding on to a narrative allows them to continue to make money, which, you know, is another story. And then secondarily to that, yeah, when you have an open murder investigation and there could be people that are found to have been involved in that murder investigation, there's, you know, they could be held accountable for that. So yeah, I think there's definitely continues to be some spin. But if I'm being honest with you, I think the damage is already done. There's been so many things that have been put out into the, for lack of a better word, the world of YouTube and books and all of this stuff that even I find funny, even in this day and age, with as much as available, there is the truth that's available there, but yet you can get lost. If you were a young kid and was like, oh my God, I want to figure out, like, good luck, right?
The rabbit hole of YouTube interviews. Yeah.
You know, and I wonder sometimes if I was younger and tried to do something like this, if I would have gotten sucked into that world, right? And got lost in it. Luckily, that's not sort of my generation. I'm a bit older, as you can see from my gray hair, that I was like, let me take this like old school journalism approach to this. And the other thing that was important to me is in doing this podcast, you know, I come out of the television world or the film world where you work with 30 people, right? Or you work in an environment where they tell you, well, you can't put this on the TV. You can't put this on air. You can't show this, or you can't do that. This is one of the only times in my career where no one was allowed or could tell me. Now, I'm not saying I didn't take creative input from people I respected, but no one could control what I said or did, and no one paid me to do it. I paid myself. I had no allegiance to the almighty dollar. I had allegiance to making the best story possible. That's it.
I get that. I am fiercely independent in my own bootstrapping here for some of the same reasons. I want to tell the story of how hip hop can save America. And I don't want to tell you, I don't want to be told you can't tell me, I can't talk about you when you're not doing that, you know, some company or whoever my sponsor might be, et cetera, et cetera. It's a nice place to be. And I think we need that in hip hop journalism. I come from the journalism world. I think we need more of that in journalism. And you see the expansion of journalists on Substack funding their own enterprises, which is great to be able to see. And I'm glad that you're able to do that. Two quick questions, I guess. We'll make them as quick as you want. I know you got to, you know, I don't want to keep you all day.
I'll stay as long as you want. And I enjoy your platform and what you do. And I think it's important. So however much time you want or need, I'm here.
I appreciate that. I truly do. So a couple of questions. We mentioned all of these folks that have been investigated or were investigated and are now not investigated. I want to ask a couple questions maybe about some specifics, like, for instance, these LAPD police officers that have been heavily implicated in all the investigations that have either come out or been covered up. The David Max, those folks, where are they now and what are they doing with their lives?
So in season two of the dossier, I do speak to Mr. Mack, and I had a very pleasant conversation about some of the questions I had. He respectfully wanted a lot of money to tell his story, and I respect that. He is living, I believe, somewhere in California, and you know, has gone about his life. Rafael Perez at one point was a livery driver. Funny enough, he drove for Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood executive. I'm not sure what he's doing now. I've heard various versions that either Perez or Mac have negotiated with Netflix, because Netflix is doing a documentary about the Rampart police scandal, and they might have Mac or Perez talk. Now, I think the tricky part of having them speak about any of this is if you take in particular Rafael Perez, when Rafael Perez was arrested by the LAPD, he took seven lie detector tests about all of the corruption he did or didn't do at the LAPD. And he lied. He did not pass one lie detector test. Okay. Also, when he described different crimes that went on within the LAPD and investigators went to investigate those crimes, they were told different stories. So no one knows what Rafael Perez did, didn't do. It's all a mystery. So how do you put someone like that on a TV screen and believe that he's going to tell an ounce of truth? I believe that on the flip side of that, because David Mack went to federal prison for the bank robbery that he had committed, and because, for lack of a better word, he was never sort of implicated in the Rampart scandal, although he was a major player in it, he would talk about the crimes that he has done his time for, okay? But that would end at the idea of the Biggie investigation and such.
Right.
So it is an interesting dynamic of it all. Amir Muhammad, the trigger man in all of this, I believe is somewhere in the South, I think in the Georgia area. Kevin Gaines was killed by another LAPD officer, Frank Liga, which is another story for another time. And so there are people that are alive that sort of had a hand in this that could be charged one day. I mean, you know, you saw what is going on in the Tupac investigation. I'm not sure that Keefe D had anything to do with it, but that's again, another story, another podcast for another time. But, you know, I think at a certain point for the city of Los Angeles, the hope would be that they would want to move on from this. But as much as institutions like the LAPD say they want to change, it's been a hard task thus far.
What do you think would take that? So again, looking at the bigger issue of police corruption, of corrupt institutions like this, you know, we've had, was it LA? No, San Francisco, maybe. You know, you've had progressive DAs in the last few years that have been elected to kind of weed out some of this stuff, overturn low-level drug convictions or not prosecute those things anymore. You know, progressive-minded that might come into a place like LA. I don't know who their DA is now, but you'll probably know. What would that take? And is it possible, in your opinion? I know we can't, you know, predict, but could anyone actually come in from and you mentioned there might be a federal looking into the overall cover-up. Is that what it takes? Is it going to take the feds? Is it something that a DA could turn around and say, you know, I got to look inside? You know, what would that take?
Well, I will say this, you know, interestingly enough, currently I am working on a new police documentary, and I've spent a lot of times inside police departments in the last 4 months. And I think it's going to take a new young version of police administrators that want to actually change things. And I'm seeing these young cops who come from a different generation are changing. And I think that is what the hope should be. And when we talk about this, you know, listen, there is the dire version of it, right? Which is like, it's not getting better. The progressive DAs have failed, right? Like that's some of the narrative. But I would actually be an optimist because of what I've seen out of these young cops. Does that make sense? Okay. I mean, that might be being more of an optimist than I should, but it's opened my eyes. And I think a new generation of understanding, like if you look at policing, there's been this old guard of policing in our major cities that come out of the Bill Bratton School of Policing, which is broken windows, stop and frisk, comp stat, all of this. And I think there's a shifting right now. And I think it's just going to take a new generation of understanding the past and hopefully coming to a middle ground, not an extreme, but a middle ground that is public safety and criminal justice, you know, that works.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we have another podcast that goes into a lot of social justice issues and We've talked about the progressive DAs and, you know, what that's going to take. But that's an interesting perspective. You know, you see it like climate change. You know, the young folks are the ones who are going to make it happen if anything's going to happen. Because, you know, like I said, the old guard, there's no incentive for them.
And I will say this, and I want to point it out because of the stuff you cover, is, you know, when these young cops have gone onto the job in this day and age, what they know is stepping into a vehicle, having a camera on their chest, having a camera in their car, having a camera pointing out, having a camera on the street, okay, that their superiors can turn on and listen and watch them do their job. Think about that.
Yeah.
Would the average human want somebody looking at them do their job the whole time? But that's all they know as young cops, right?
Right. And they also don't have old habits to break.
Yes. Yeah. Is a thing to think about, right? And so, you know, when I look at the future of this stuff, I'm a little bit more hopeful but I'm also a realist with a lot of this stuff is still a mess, you know?
Yeah. I got you. One other thing I forgot to mention since you stayed on for a little bit more time. One of the interesting things that I heard about through your coverage was this, and we talked about this idea of disinformation, that how much of this investigation was sort of derailed or diverted because of a journalist.
Yeah.
Can you give a little? Yeah. Give me a little bit on that, because that was really fascinating to find out.
Yeah. So, and I go into that in a bigger way in season two. You know, Chuck Phillips worked at the LA Times, and this is a fact. This isn't like me, you know, speculating. There was an LAPD official whose name was Mike Burkow. And Mike Burkow was underneath Bill Bratton, which at that time was the commissioner of the LAPD. And Mike Burkow was feeding Chuck Phillips information and stories to plant into the LA Times to out, you know, a confidential informant, to sort of derail, you know, what Phil Carson was doing. There had to be a meeting at the FBI between the FBI and Chuck Phillips to say, what are you doing? Like, what is going on here? And it's really interesting. What I did recently is I went back into the archive of the Los Angeles Times, and I pulled all of Chuck Phillips' articles from that whole time period. And you can kind of see where he made this shift and got in bed with the LAPD. And Chuck Phillips is someone who has gone into hiding. We think we know where he is, but he, ever since this has gone down, he's disappeared completely off the map, to never be heard from again, never has written again, never has gone on a podcast. And in this day and age, where he probably could come out of hiding and get a check for $100,000, $150,000, this is a man who continues to stay in hiding for various reasons. I've been told he has recordings of LAPD officials. I have sources that told me he has recordings of Suge Knight. I have, you know, that he has information even about the sort of corruption that went on within Snoop Dogg's murder trial. Chuck Phillips is the last, I think, bastion of like secrets and information and a treasure trove of like, tell me what happened that hasn't talked yet. So again, I say this, there is another story in the story of Biggie and Tupac. And that, funny enough, is this journalist at the LA Times who covered all of this at the time it was going on and was in bed with Suge, you know, was getting paid by Suge. And what I don't know what happened, but for a man like that to completely disappear, something serious must have happened. So it's another piece of this story that I would love to tell, that I'm trying to tell, but I got to get Chuck Phillips to talk. So Chuck, if you're listening, come talk to me.
Yeah. It's not suspicious at all that you disappeared. but yeah, obviously someone in that position would be the one to talk to. And that brings up sort of one of my, again, it's first of all, it's voluminous how much work you've put in and gone through and covered, and the season one, season two, there's a lot to go through when you really start going down your rabbit hole specifically, even just the podcast. But one of the things that I'm getting from it, which is striking, is that if not for the legend, the myth, the fame of Biggie Smalls and the public interest, the family interest, the journalism interest, the people who are doing the continuous questioning, even to this day, what you know now to be true would probably not have been discovered or come to light or be hidden in one of the cops' hidden desk drawer file cabinets, right? It would still be there. No one would know. Maybe these guys got fired because of the other stuff, the Rampart stuff. Maybe they don't. And it just kind of disappears. And it makes me wonder how many other non-biggies, you know, were treated sort of the same way, but because not for that fame and that interest, we never know.
It's an interesting you brought that up, because that to me is actually the other reason of why I really wanted to do this. Because I just said, imagine if they can do this to one of the biggest,
right,
you know, music superstars to ever live, and there is information in plain sight that shows you what happened to him, and yet the powers that be are able to manipulate, cover up, blackmail, whatever words you want to use to make sure the truth doesn't come out. What that tells you is a life that is a life, which is all of our rights as human beings.
Yeah.
How easy would that be for them to put a file in a drawer when a cop does something wrong, or there was a bad shooting, there was whatever it is. It's very, it becomes very easy. If you can do that to that level of individual, then, you know, and Phil Carson tells the story of sitting in a big meeting with FBI officials and LAPD officials. And one of these LAPD officials says to Phil Carson, "Why do you care? This is just some crack dealer from Brooklyn." And Phil looked at him and kind of in disbelief that he would say this in a public setting, because it's moronic, and just thought to himself, you know, man, you guys really have this wrong if you think that this is okay and that it's just a cost of doing business, right, of society. And so you bring up a great point. And I was watching this documentary recently about the Boston Police Department. And sure enough, who do I see as the chief of police as this massive scandal is going on is Bill Bratton. And I said to myself, man, here is a guy who is considered the pinnacle of police management policy of our country. But yet every police department he's been in, from the Boston Police Department to the NYPD to the LAPD, he's been the head of massive cover-ups that have resulted in the, for lack of a better word, ruining of people's lives, you know, people going to jail for things that they didn't do, you know, people being planted guns and drugs on them. And who does that go to? It should land at the feet of a police commissioner, yet he's exalted in our society as this like kingmaker within policing. And I think that's important to talk about, that these patterns have gone on for 30 years. And when are you going to break those patterns? I would argue, until the Bill Brattons of the world are called to the mat about what has happened underneath their watch, this is going to continue to happen, because they've trained and have put in power a cabal of police commissioners across the country in our major cities. They're disciples who can understand. Well, Bill was able to, this is how Bill handled the hidden files. He had a guy.
Right.
And let's get a guy who can hide files, because we have to do that, right?
Right.
And so it's really incredible when you think about it, you know? And I think if you don't really ingest and study all of this stuff, it's sort of, you don't know, right? And if you don't know, you don't know. But there's that part of it that, like, I think these stories, although this is a hip hop story, although this is a Biggie story, this is more about criminal justice, social justice, and police corruption. And that's it at the end of the day.
I hear that. And I talk about hip hop as being sort of this undervalued commodity. Well, commodity is a terrible word for it, but it's a culture that we don't respect it enough. And all the purpose of the work I do is to show people who are using hip hop in wonderful, amazing ways to help uplift humanity. And in my back of my mind, I'd be like, it would be kind of cool if the killing of one of our most beloved, you know, artists ends up being some vehicle for change somehow or another. If this lawsuit, the civil suit, does turn into something, if somebody is held accountable and it goes up the chain and it does take a Bill Bratton or that kind of level accountability, you know, and then you have young folks that are coming up with this as their cultural DNA. They kind of know this story and they're coming up differently. All of these things might happen, maybe in part, some little part, to the tragedy that befell our community. So maybe that happens. Yeah. I'm an optimist too, my man. I'm an optimist too. Funny side story. The one time I was quoted, you're from New York, I'm from New York. The one time I was quoted in the Daily News was calling Bill Bratton a bigot because he called rappers mostly thugs in response to something that happened at a place. Funny side story.
I've been thinking in the last week or so that I should really tell a story about Bill Bratton. And it just, when I saw him on that documentary, I like scratched my head and I'm like, holy shit. Like, are you serious? You know? So anyway, that's just another aside to our conversation.
All right. Well, we have that interest in common. So we'll holler. So listen, again, you touched upon it at points in this. I just kind of want to put a bow on it. If you would, your work. Well, two things. Number one, what's coming up with the rest of the dossier that you know about, because as you said, certain things pop up along the way. So what is kind of the can we expect over the next, you know, few episodes, certainly? And then again, you touched on it, but overall, what is the goal? What do you hope that your work accomplishes, and how is it directing the other things that you're now looking to do in your career?
Yeah, I think with the dossier, what I've tried to do this season is take what I call the Wallace family civil documents that they used when the city of Los Angeles was sued, and really take people into the amount and the mountain of evidence that exists that shows LAPD was involved. That was one. The second part of the season is to show how a massive journalistic institution, the Los Angeles Times, and one journalist was able to shift public narrative around this case with misinformation and sort of question why, how did this happen, and was there motive or reason behind it? And so for me, I just feel my next step in all of this is I would like to file, I'd say I'm preparing a laundry list of Freedom of Information Act requests to the U.S. Attorney's Office, to the LAPD, because there still are documents that are inside of the LAPD that could tell more and more of this story, and I would like to get my hands on them. So I want to continue to do that. And with my work, at the end of the day, my hope as a journalist and as a television producer is just like to continue to try and tell important stories around our criminal justice system, because there's many stories to be told. There's many, you know, fixes that need to be made if we're going to be a civilized society and talk about rehabilitation and what goes on around that. So my hope is to continue to look for stories that define the American criminal justice system and shine the light on things that maybe people didn't know about, you know, or individuals that people go, wow, I didn't know that part of that story, right? And so that's the hope that I continue to do and hope to do moving forward.
Yeah. Well, for those who are interested in, you know, the Biggie story, there were a lot of times that I've said, well, I didn't know that about the story. So in terms of this case, you're doing it. The work you're doing is doing it. Even the folks who have been kind of tuned in, don't go down the rabbit holes too often of, you know, of internet salaciousness. So I appreciate the approach. I appreciate the dedication, to be honest, because this has been now a long time following this one major story. And I can see why it's so convoluted and there are new twists and turns. And at the very center of it, perhaps a giant bankrupt city, which is amazing to think that that could, you know, that that's part of the factors at play when it was just some crack dealer from Brooklyn that got shot. No big deal, right? You know, so.
That's what the LAPD thought, you know.
Yeah. Well, they thought wrong. Thank you for your work and for taking the time to kick it with me. Is there anything else you'd like to share that I might have left out? Where can just people follow, you know, and do all the things?
Yeah, no, if people want more information about the project and the release of these documents, they can go to criminalmindedmedia.com. And, you know, the dossier is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And season two is currently up there, but you can go back and listen to season one. And you also, within the feed, you can listen to the story of James Rosemond or Jimmy Henchman, who many people understand. And I followed his drug cases. And so there's another criminal justice story there to listen to. So if people are interested, yep, that's where you can find everything. And Manny, thank you for your work. It's rare that I get to meet people like you who are doing similar work, and it's not easy. So I appreciate you having me on the platform.
I know that is true, and I appreciate the appreciation. So and I respect you back. Thank you. Come back when we have some more to talk about. You're always welcome to, you know, share new findings that you might want to let folks know about. So thanks again, Don.
Thanks, Manny.
Once again, thanks for listening to another episode of Hip Hop Can Save America, a.k.a. the world's most important hip-hop podcast. My name is Manny Faces. You can find out more about the show at hiphopcansaveamerica.com. You can watch the show now as a live stream on YouTube, hiphopcansaveamerica.com/watch. Check back for all the replays as well. The interviews from the live stream will be brought here onto the audio feed, so you always get the best of the live stream. You can also check out our Substack newsletter. It's free at mannyfaces.substack.com, filled with stories of hip-hop innovation, inspiration, and in general, hip-hop news that isn't about dumb shit. Eternal shouts to our consulting producer, Summer McCoy. Be sure to check out her dope initiatives, Hip Hop Hacks, and the Mixtape Museum. We'll be back soon with another dope episode, but check us out on the live stream as well. Mondays, 9 p.m. Eastern, hiphopcansaveamerica.com/watch. Until next time, it's Manny Faces wishing peace and love to you and yours. Once again, thanks for listening to another episode of Hip Hop Can Save America, a.k.a. the world's most important hip-hop podcast. My name is Manny Faces. You can find out more about the show at hiphopcansaveamerica.com. You can watch the show now as a live stream on YouTube, hiphopcansaveamerica.com/watch. Check back for all the replays as well. The interviews from the live stream will be brought here onto the audio feed, so you always get the best of the live stream. You can also check out our Substack newsletter. It's free at mannyfaces.substack.com. Filled with stories of hip-hop innovation, inspiration, and in general, hip-hop news that isn't about dumb shit. Eternal shouts to our consulting producer, Summer McCoy. Be sure to check out her dope initiatives, Hip-Hop Hacks, and the Mixtape Museum. We'll be back soon with another dope episode, but check us out on the live stream as well. Mondays, 9 p.m. Eastern, hiphopcansaveamerica.com/watch. Until next time, it's Manny Faces wishing peace and love to you and yours.